Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
This is the Michael K. Show podcast. Listen live weekday afternoon starting at 3 on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, or on your smart speaker by asking it to play ESPN New York 98.7.
Hey Alexa, play ESPN New York 98.7.
The guy who put this all together, director, and one of the producers as well, Jason Hare, and he joins us now on the show. Jason, it's Michael, Don, and Peter. How are you doing?
I'm great, guys. How are you?
Good. Now, I don't want to put pressure on you, but in college, I learned the phrase magnum opus. I would think that this is your magnum opus. You're still a very relatively young man. And when you sit back, you go, well, how do I top that? Do you ever have a moment like that?
Yeah, I hope not. I hope it's not all downhill from here. But, you know, I'm just trying to kind of come down from this and you know, talking to a lot of members of the team today, and all of us are just kind of giving each other socially distant high fives. We thought we'd be on a roof deck somewhere right now celebrating with each other. But, yeah, I haven't thought that much about the future. This is the first Monday in 2.5 years that I haven't been thinking actively about how to make this doc or finalize it or do last edits. So just taking it day by day.
Now, it seemed like such an arduous task to put together 10 one-hour shows. But, you know, I've been reading stories and interviews that you've done with Richard Deitch of The Athletic. Could it have been longer? Could you have done a 20-part series?
I don't know about 20, but these parts definitely could have been longer. You know, when you work with a network like ESPN and it's going to air on television, they have ads, obviously, they have to run. So we have to hit 50 minutes exactly for each episode.
Right.
And if you wrote a book for 10 chapters, you wouldn't necessarily write, you know, 20 pages per chapter. Some chapters can be 40 pages, some can be 18 pages. It depends on the story that you're telling. And it's the same with this, is that we could have made episode one probably 65 minutes. Episode two could have been about that same time. Some of the episodes should have been a little bit shorter. But we definitely had more minutes, more stories to mine, more sound bites to put in there. There's a lot of stuff that hit the floor, a lot of great details that hit the floor that I would have loved to include. But you're working in an environment where you know, every second counts and every minute is at a premium. So there's a lot of stuff that hit the floor. I don't think that we certainly couldn't do additional episodes after this 98 run ended, but we could have beefed up the earlier episodes if we were given that leeway.
Real quick, what's the worst thing that hit the floor? Is there one thing that sits in your mind like, I can't believe we didn't get that in?
I love the story about Michael's early years and the evolution of him from the time that he was a high school sophomore to when he was, you know, cut from the team to when he's a high school senior and he's all of a sudden the best player in the country. It was just a meteoric rise for those 2 years and what went through all the permutations of how that happened. They had to lie to get him into the five-star basketball camp. He goes up there. No one knows who he is. He's Mike Jordan from Wilmington. You got guys like Ewing and Lenny Bias and Chris Mullen. Chris Carter, the receiver, was there. And this kid comes in and blows the doors off of everybody. And they had to beg him to stay for a second week because all these coaches want to take a look at him. So he goes up there as a no-name. And on the way home, Lefty Driesell makes him stop at Maryland, like convinces his parents, please stop at Maryland to visit because he was an overnight sensation. So it's stories like that. And then the relationships, you know, Roy Williams was a quote machine. And the relationship that he had with Michael at UNC and some of the pool games they used to play and how angry Michael would get it if Roy beat him in pool. Roy became really close with the family and James Jordan built Roy Williams a wood stove because Roy was making about $8,000 or $10,000 a year at that point as a part-time assistant for Dean Smith. And James Jordan is great with his hands and he built him a wood stove and installed it in his house as a thank you just for being a friend. It wasn't
wow.
A week of NCAA violations of guys giving you gifts, but rarely does the player give the coach a gift like that. He wanted to do that. James Jordan built the second story of Michael's childhood home with his bare hands. The kids were getting bigger and there wasn't enough room. So instead of moving, James Jordan said, I'm just going to rip the roof off and build the second story of this house by myself. And that's what he did. That's the work ethic. That Michael observed his entire life. So when you see Michael sticking his tongue out in the dunk, It's because he used to observe his father working on cars and working on the house, and he used to stick his tongue out when he was doing construction work. And that's why Michael did that, because he would copy his dad as a kid. So those are the kind of stories, that his formative years, that I really wanted to tell, but we had so many other stories to tell early in the series that it didn't make sense chronologically to go back to his childhood late in the series.
Jason, a two-pronged question about the final episode towards the end of Episode 10. When he was handed the computer to show the footage of Jerry Reinsdorf's reason for breaking the team up, Michael muttered something like, "I have my theory." I think that's what he said, something to that effect. Did you know what that theory was? And did you think of, or was there impossible to go back and ask the members of the 98 team whether they would have signed a one-year contract to come back for a seventh run?
He didn't expound upon what he meant. I have my theories as to what it was. I can only assume he meant it's about money, or it's about an untenable relationship between Phil and Jerry. I mean, I think that's what it came down to, really. And it's a shame that 82-0 quote was uttered to Phil, but I think that's where they lost Phil. I think at that point he's too prideful a person to say, okay, you told me I could go 82-0, you'll never have me. We won another title, and now you want me back. And who knows what Jerry would say if he ever would have been willing to do that, because Jerry Krause, that is, because Jerry Reinsdorf, it never came to that because Phil said no right away. I don't remember exactly what their answers were, but I never put it to them singularly, like, would you come back for a year? I can't imagine. I think Scotty would have been the toughest. I did ask Michael outright, do you think you could have convinced Scotty? And he said, yes, I think I could have convinced Scotty to come back. Scotty would have, you know, Scotty at that point was his views of management were way off the reservation. And he ended up getting $67.2 million from the Houston Rockets in that offseason. So I think they would have had to pay a lot of money to get him back. But, yeah, you saw that was some unvarnished stuff there from Michael, because it surprised me that he had never heard any explanation from Jerry Reinsdorf, but they apparently never had that conversation.
Now, one thing, I look at the 10 parts, Jason, I think it was just close to perfection, but I wonder why we didn't get a look at Michael Jordan, the father. I mean, the first chance we even heard from the kids were when they were older, why they couldn't go to Utah. Is that something that Michael didn't want you to explore?
This is a line that I had to toe for years, and it was, is this thing a Bulls documentary or is it a Michael Jordan documentary? And the first time that I met with Michael in September of 2017, he said to me, this is not the definitive Michael Jordan documentary. You can do that when I'm in a pine box 6 feet under. I remember him saying that to me. I think that he doesn't want to look at himself. When you do a definitive documentary on someone, it means that the story is over. And he's a 57-year-old man. I think that he looks at himself as young. He doesn't look at himself as a grandfather, even though he is one, a proud grandfather. He's got a lot of life to live, and he doesn't want to tell the definitive story of Michael Jordan's life. If we did that, if we do, you know, him as a dad and as a husband and his home life, then it veers way towards being a Michael Jordan doc and not a Bulls doc. And we would have had to take out some significant storylines in other places in order to make the room for that. And if we're not doing that for Scottie Pippen and Phil Jackson and Steve Kerr and Dennis Rodman and Tony Kukoc, by the way, that's another guy who deserves his own full documentary for what he went through just to get to America and his home life. If we do that, then the question can be asked then, okay, you did the family life, you did the home life, you did Michael as a dad. Where's the stuff about the Wizards? Where's the stuff about him owning the Hornets? Where's the Hall of Fame speech? I thought this was a Michael Jordan documentary. So it's very, very tough to have to straddle that line. And, you know, I'm proud of our team. I'm proud of the stories that we told. But it was a constant struggle for us to figure out exactly what this thing was going to be as it evolved.
Were you able to ever gauge what players Michael actually truly respected? You get the sense he respected Bird and Magic, that there was just something about them that he admired. After that, to me, it seems tough to tell who he actually respected. Did you get any gauge for that?
You mean opponents?
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. I think for all of his bluster, for, you know, saying he had no problem with the glove and all that, and Gary gave everybody problems, and Michael can laugh at it now because I think Michael thinks about championships. He thinks about team. And that's why, you know, he said, Karl Malone, okay, great. You can have that. You can have the MVP trophy. I want this. I want the ring. I think that the most telling story that he told me, and we didn't get a chance to even really get into it when we told the LeBradford Smith story, but he did tell me that he took away from that LeBradford Smith. Do you guys remember that story?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
So he said that his takeaway from that LeBradford Smith thing was that he always respected every opponent he had on every night after that. Because any, he said, that proved to me that if you get to the NBA, I don't care if I've heard of you or if I haven't, you have the potential to go off on any given night. Mm. And he said that taught him the lesson that that can happen at any time. When you make it to the NBA, you're that good a player that you're capable of going off for 37 points, even if no one's really heard of you. So I think that he's got several personas. There's Michael. There's Air Jordan, who wears the cape and laughs at the iPad and scoffs at people saying they're better than him.
Uh-huh.
And then there's Michael the competitor and Michael the kid who was coached by Dean Smith and respects the game so much that he goes out there, and that's why he works as hard as he works. It's because he's got so much respect for the game. So I think it's fun, and he can turn it on and off. He knows how to be a charismatic subject of a documentary. And say those things and roll his eyes like that. But I think that deep down he had respect for all of these guys.
All right, now here's something, Jason. I've traveled with teams for 35 years. Every single star player has an alias that they're registered under in hotels. I can't buy Jordan's version of the pizza story. Number one, how would the pizza delivery boys or guys know that it was for Michael Jordan? And number two, his bodyguards and his trainer were suspicious. How would they have let him eat that pizza? It doesn't make sense to me, Jason.
I wasn't in the room that night. I know what they told me. I know one thing that this is what everyone had said, including Michael, is that he was skipped for dinner that night.
Okay.
He was out of the room. I think they were at shoot around or something, and the guys ate, who he hangs out with, the security guards and George and Tim Grover, they ate already. And he was pissed off at that. So when they ordered that pizza, he said, no one else is touching this because this is mine because you guys skipped me. So he wouldn't let anyone have any of that pizza. So it does make sense to me that he ate pizza that night. I mean, if you want to pick it apart, it's a fun game to play. None of us were there. But, I mean, do you think he didn't eat pizza at all?
Well, I mean, let's say he ate pizza that could have been tainted, but five guys coming up there and his bodyguards are there and they're suspicious.
I don't believe five guys. Yeah. I don't believe five guys.
If there's one guy who came...
What I think happened. My guess is that a pizza delivery guy, first of all, they're on the outskirts of Salt Lake City, which is not right. Another party town to begin with. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if the guy who works the front desk at this hotel knows the guy who comes to deliver the pizza. And he says, hey, you're going up to 522.
That's a good point.
That's Michael Jordan's room. And it wouldn't surprise me if the pizza guy either called the one other dude who was working. There's not five guys working at any pizzeria in Salt Lake City that late at night. No way. So I think that maybe a couple of guys, maybe from the staff in the hotel, went up with the pizza guy to take a look inside the room and see Michael Jordan. I mean, he was that much of an attraction. But I don't think that's first of all, if you're going to poison the pizza and deliver a poison pizza, you don't go. You're trying to be as inconspicuous as possible. You don't go up there five deep, knocking on the door. So I think that it probably was less than five. I think it was probably more than one guy at the door. I think through deliberate methods or not, that pizza did not agree with Michael.
That's
you don't wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning with stabbing pains, curled up on the ground. Having convulsions and throwing up uncontrollably from cigars and wine or tequila. Like, that doesn't happen. That's something wrong with it.
And honestly, not usually from the flu either.
No, it's definitely not the flu.
Yeah,
everyone agrees it wasn't the flu. So, you know, I think dehydration probably had something to do with it. They're at altitude. I heard that had something to do with it. Who knows? But I think that the takeaway from the story is that he was feeling like, you know, absolute crud and performed the way that he did.
I got to tell you what, Jason, so much from this documentary moved me, but I thought your handling of Steve Kerr was just magnificent. And it really did amplify how important Kerr was the last three. But putting the father into it, and then after he says when he hears the national anthem, and then you bing, you go to a clip from that game. It's almost as if the guys that shot that knew that Steve Kerr was going to say that all those years later. It was magnificent the way that was done.
Yeah, it's a testament to them. The guys who shot that footage were brilliant. Obviously, they had no idea that 22 years later we were going to or 23 years later, we were going to tell the story of Steve hitting the shot in that game and so on. But meeting Steve and meeting Ann Kerr was one of the highlights of this entire process for me. There could be and should be a full doc done on Steve's life and on his family, because really Steve is he's an academic who just happens to be in a professional athlete's body, and with the abilities, at least, of a professional athlete, not maybe the prototypical professional athlete's body. But he came from a house with two professors in it. He said in the doc he wasn't even allowed to watch TV on school nights unless it was a game. I mean, he came from a rigorous academic family and went on to win 5 rings as a player and 3 more as a coach. I mean, he's prolific. So,
yeah.
And Ann Kerr, for us, I mean, we're walking around in socks in her home. She let us in her home, and that is, it looks like a movie set, but that's where Steve grew up. And that was his living room when he grew up, and she's sitting on that couch that was Steve's couch when he was a little kid that he was doing his homework on. And for her to let us into the home physically and emotionally to let us in during that interview, it was just really spectacular. I can't thank the Kerr family enough.
Did Steve mention the decision for him to wear Warriors gear during it? Because obviously he knows where his bread is buttered, and I thought that was a really smart thing for him, for Warriors fans. But was it discussed at all that he would wear that in his interview?
Yeah, I thought it was a bad look, though, Peter. And I also thought it was a bad look that he didn't shave, but that's just
me. Why do you think it was a bad look? Oh, you didn't like the shirt? You thought it was a bad decision?
Yeah, I mean, because this isn't a Warriors thing.
He was worried. My assumption, Jason, tell me if you had a conversation, was that he felt to be in this huge Bulls thing, when now he's completely associated with the Warriors, he didn't like, I think, the idea that people would think he's nostalgic for the Bulls. Did you guys discuss that?
I think you guys are overthinking it, because that was an off day in New York City between Nets and the Knicks game, and they had a shoot-around that day. He came directly from the shoot-around and worked out in the hotel gym.
Well, that'll do it then.
He came directly from the gym in the gear that he had gone to the shoot-around in, and that was it. He just sat down. I don't think he even thought of it.
That's really funny. Now, where do you end up landing, Jason, on Michael overall? I mean, you showed us so much of him. There are parts when he really seems psychotic and just like a lunatic of a competitor. And then you have the stories about Gus yesterday, where he seems like this shockingly regular guy at times. Between the interviews and just your interactions with him, where do you land on Michael Jordan, the person?
I never thought not highly of him, because I didn't know him, and I just admired him as a kid like we all did. But I think so much more highly of him than I expected to think. And that's not meant to be, you know, this kind of like sycophant filmmaker who's just telling this puff piece, which I know has been out there, that's what we were. And that's not what that's trying to sound like. I just saw the human side of him, and that doesn't even mean how he treated me. It's how he treated the makeup artist. It's how he treated our camera crew. It's how he interacted. I've been around him now enough, not much, but certainly enough to get a pretty good sample of how he treats those in his inner circle and those how he treats those directly around him. So I just thought he would be a lot more aloof, a lot more guarded, a lot less generous with his candor and his vulnerability, and with his honesty. It would have been easy for him to sidestep so many of these questions and just give the typical athlete answer that he would give, you know, in a scrum in front of his locker. But he came to play immediately. I could tell he walked in that first day and was in a good mood and shook everybody's hand, and someone offered him a cigar, and there was the makeup artist was pregnant, and he said, "No, we can't smoke a cigar." And he was a pregnant woman here. It was in the room that they were doing it. So it's just like this was Southern, polite Southern Michael who showed up that day. And then 15-20 minutes into that first interview is when I said that they were called the Chicago Bulls Traveling Cocaine Circus. And for him to lean his head back and give us that belly laugh, it would have been really easy for him just to kind of snicker and say, "Yeah, I'm not too sure about that. Those are crazy days." But that huge laugh acknowledged it was true. And then he went a step further and gave an anecdote about what it felt like for him coming from Chapel Hill to experience that. So he was all in from the beginning. And it wasn't long after that, which is when he got emotional, what you saw at the end of episode 7. So he came to play very early on, and I give him all the credit in the world, because he, as he said, did not have to do this. The man's worth almost $2 billion. He doesn't, and he's very comfortable with where he sits on the Mount Rushmore of NBA athletes and global athletes in any sport. He did not have to do this, but he did, and he came, showed up, and he did not just give us lip service. He showed up in spirit. So I give him all the credit in the world.
Talking with Jason Hare, the director of The Last Dance, which was magnificent over the last 5 weeks. I wonder, you've received such accolades for this work, Jason. Did it bother you? Did it bring a little bit of shade into what should have been a sunny time when Ken Burns said, this can't be a documentary if Michael Jordan was involved in making it?
No, it hurt a little bit as the kid inside me was hurt a little bit because I grew up worshiping Ken Burns and still admire him to this day. He is the quintessential documentary filmmaker. His body of work is extraordinary. But he reached out to me and explained the context with which some of his quotes were taken, and he regretted that the context was in his thought incorrect. And he told me what he meant to say and could not have been more gracious or classier. And he said that he had every intention of watching it. And he said that he was sorry for any heartache, was the word that he used, that it may have caused me, because he knows better than anybody how much effort and passion and blood, sweat, and tears goes into making something like this. So I thought it was just really big of him and really impressive of him as a person, not just as a filmmaker, to reach out like that.
What was in Michael's glass in one of those interviews? Was that scotch?
I don't know, because I was much more focused on him sitting down and getting him to sit down in that chair and actually getting him talking, so I don't know.
Music Pain sent out a tweet, I guess just thanking you for the Pearl Jam at the end of episode 10, but I'll formulate into a question. How did you come up with the different music during the course of the shows?
Well, the hip-hop music was very personal to me because I've been a huge hip-hop fan from the time Michael came into the league. And I just thought it would be a really cool thread to show the parallel rise of hip-hop in the culture, in American and global culture, and Michael's rise in American and the Bulls' rise in American and global culture. So, you know, for a song like I Ain't No Joke, Rakim, Michael was the Rakim of the NBA. He took the existing culture and stood it on its head. And was playing a different sport, it seemed like, when he came in. And Rakim did the same thing to rap music when he came in. I'll vividly remember the first time I heard Paid in Full, the album from which that song is taken. And it was unlike any rap music I'd ever heard. So that was fun to kind of play with the eras and try and match the eras to songs from the era.
And you really, you did a great job year by year, too. I mean, even with the KRS-One Step Into a World, like it seemed like every year you really... whoever was music supervising for you also really got it right.
Yeah, we were trying to really match a song with the era, but not have it be so obvious that it was, you know, Fantastic Voyage is probably the poppiest hip-hop song that we had. Maybe Hip Hop Hooray, Naughty by Nature. But
both worked. They both worked. Yeah, Fantastic Voyage, exactly. You don't hear that often, even though it was a huge smash. It still felt good to hear in context.
Yeah, and I think what was refreshing for a lot of people is that they haven't seen a lot of Michael videos set to those old school rap songs, because back then they weren't doing that. When the NBA Superstars, that VHS came out that you used to get free with Sports Illustrated.
Love that
video,
yeah.
You know, every guy had their own song, and Michael's song was Take My Breath Away.
I know. I posted that after one of the episodes. By the way, Jason, did you laugh as hard as I did when you got to see the clip that you showed last night of them going, what's you listening to, Mike? And he goes, the new Kenny Lattimore. I mean, I know him. Like, well, Michael Jordan showing off that he knows Kenny Lattimore just cracked me up.
I had to Google Kenny Lattimore. I thought it might have been like the ball boy or something like that. I had no idea who Kenny Lattimore was.
A very middle-of-the-road R&B artist.
Yeah, I'm not. That is not the genre of music that I was listening to at that time. But I understand that, like, I think his Spotify numbers went crazy last night. He posted something, and I give credit to my editors because they were reading Michael's lips and matching the beats per minute of the songs on the album that would have come out then to figure out exactly what song that is. So that song that we play is the exact song that Michael was listening to in his head.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
It's called Days
That's
Like
amazing.
This by Kenny Lattimore.
Wow. Have you heard from Michael Jordan?
I have not.
Oh, come on. You should pick up the phone. You did an unbelievable job. You should be so proud of this work. You don't need me to tell you, but it served as such a respite from these ugly times that we're living in right now. It was brilliant of ESPN to move it up the way they did. You deserve nothing but plaudits. You really do. It's just magnificent.
I appreciate it, Mike.
All right. Be good. Take care.
All right. See you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show podcast. Hear more of Michael, Don, and Peter live weekday afternoon starting at 3 on 98.7 ESPN in New York, the ESPN app, and on your smart speaker by asking it to play ESPN New York 98.7.
Hey, Alexa, play ESPN New York 98.7.
For more than 80 years, Nissan has been there for you, and now is no different. We're offering flexible payment options for current NMAP customers. Our service departments are here to help. And for future owners, we're now offering more help. Deferred payments for 3 months on 11 models. Plus, we'll cover your payments for up to 2 additional months. Plus, get 0% APR financing for up to 60 months on 10 models. This is help when you need it. Visit NissanUSA.com today to learn more. Nissan, innovation that excites. Offers available to well-qualified buyers on purchase of an eligible 2020 Nissan from new dealer stock when financed through Nissan Motor Acceptance Corporation. Subject to NMAC credit approval and max term limit. Subject to residency restrictions. NMAC special APR cash amount is capped and varies by vehicle from $500 to $2,000, which customer can apply toward up to 2 monthly payments. Customer is responsible for all payments. Delayed payment must begin 90 days from date of contract. Accrual of interest commences from contract date and consumer responsible for accrued interest. Dealer participation may vary. Call 1-888-858-8319 for offer details, including list of eligible models and service availability. Offers end 6-1-20.